Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician tonight, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how we can make changes to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal spiritual empowerment. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free from any place in the world at 1-877-876-5227 or call direct at 530-876-3222. The show is carried online, and in many parts of the country, you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for the show is up and can be found on the BBS Radio site at thespiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. This show and all past shows are available now on the station archives. Today, we have yet another update on the continuing saga of Ada L. Smith, senator from New York. You'll remember that a few weeks ago we heard from one of the New York State Senator's victims, Doug Green. Doug had refused to just take it and instead pursued justice in the face of indifference and ridicule after he had been assaulted in 2002 by State Senator from New York, Ada Smith. Doug, during that hour, shared with us his frustration with and Smith's long record of abuse and assault directed against her staff and the general staff for the New York legislature. Along with that, he recounted the perks that Smith enjoys in her position of privilege. Last week, we had another update about the stirrings of activity in the district attorney's office as an ADA was assigned to the case and sent from Albany into the city to interview the several victims. We all wondered, would it happen or would it not? Well, now we have an answer. Today, we can confirm that the ADA did, in fact, go to New York City and interview Doug. Doug spent a half an hour being interviewed on Wednesday in the back of a big black limousine that brought the ADA into New York. A grand jury is now in the offing. And after that, indictments for the senator who can't keep her hands, her coffee, or her vitriol off her office workers is in the works. As I said before, perhaps we should thank Ada Smith for making the wrong thing so obvious that even the jaded forces of tomfoolery in New York cannot possibly ignore what has happened. And on April 21st, the New York Times reported that the senator's behavior has become so public and so outrageous that even her own normally complacent constituents have become aroused. In an article in that publication, Jonathan Hicks wrote, "For several years now, State Senator Ada L. Smith has been the subject of the kind of unflattering headlines about her behavior that would place most any political career in jeopardy. And then, just a month ago, Ms. Smith, a Queens Democrat, was accused of throwing coffee in the eyes of a staff member and was charged with third-degree assault. While New York voters have actually tended to be forgiving of their state lawmakers when they run afoul of the law, this latest accusation against Ms. Smith seems to have set off a protest among her constituents in Southeast Queens, with some saying enough is enough. In the series of interviews in Ms. Smith's senatorial district, many civic officials, business leaders, and even her fellow politicians say that the sheer volume of accusations and charges against the senator over the years has simply depleted any goodwill they might have felt toward her during this recent problem. Quote, I think people here are disturbed by the preponderance of issues that she has found herself immersed in, said City Councilman Leroy G. Comrie, whose district includes parts of Ms. Smith's Senate district. Most people are embarrassed by the fact that this seems to be a regular occurrence. And that was a report from the New York Times. If it took this long for the legislature to do something about Ada Smith, how would you like them to be the ones who had to make sure your toilet flushes? The spiritual politician is a show that raises the issues, that illustrates just how government really operates and for whom. And by extrapolation, shows us the difference between the rules in politics and the rules you and I truly believe we should live by as people of faith. The Ada Smith story brings with it several points. How is Ada going to know what is wrong if no one lets her know? And that brings us to the story of a man and his puppy. There was a man who, he was lonely, he lived alone, and he went down and he bought himself a puppy at the animal shelter. And he brought it home, and because he was lonely and he didn't want to be hard on the little puppy, he let the puppy do what the puppy wanted. And a puppy, being the puppy, and having never been housebroken, did his business on the floor, usually right in front of the fireplace. And the man just simply cleaned up after him. And this went on for months and months and months, and the puppy got larger and larger, and then one day the man noticed it wasn't a puppy anymore. It was a dog, and it was doing its business on the rug in front of the fireplace. So he shot it. Of course, you and I know that what he really should have done was to train the puppy when it was a puppy. And the corollary with this story is that Ada obviously needed some training. Government is trying to be our conscience as we live out our relationships with each other, and you know what? It's not competent to do that. That was not the scenario that Jesus had in mind, now, was it? Jesus was very specific about Caesar, and all government is the moral equivalent of Caesar. It is for us to decide, not just because we're free to act, but because being free, it makes the most possible for us to test and try and refine our spirits, better to do his will. So how are people right now today breaking out of the government grid to find ways back to their spiritual lives for themselves? That point brings us to our guest for this evening, Jerry Corbetta. Jerry is a rocker. You've heard his music. If you've ever heard Green Eyed Lady, that gold record was Jerry's, and it hangs in his living room. His other songs helped define the 50s and the 60s generation. Music speaks directly to our souls, doesn't it? All of us know that, and those that make the music are woven into our consciousness in ways that we can hardly even imagine. So how does that relate to government? Government is one form of centralization. The music industry historically was subject to another form, and rockers like Jerry look for solutions that are now changing that industry. Where solutions exist, people, including rockers, will find them. Jerry is not a political kind of guy, far from it. He's a musician. Jerry and many other musicians have taken the tools of this generation, the internet, and applied those tools to make themselves more free. Tonight, Jerry and I will be talking about how he and others have accomplished that off-gridding. Jerry, you're welcome to our show.
Thank you, Melinda.
And I'm so glad that you could be with us this evening. And as always, we start by asking you to tell us something about your background. So, you were born in Colorado, right?
That's true. Born in Denver, Colorado. And I grew up in a house of music. My father was quite a successful business person, and we had a big house. And my father loved music, and my older sister played the trumpet, and when I was a very young man, her band practiced in our house. And so I got into music as a very young 4- and 5-year-old boy. And I started out by playing the drums with my sister. We played on USO shows a lot.
Well, that must have been fun.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
This was a family thing.
Well, pretty much. Well, my father was not a musician, but he really supported, you know, he loved us and he supported our music and really opened some doors, you know, for us.
So you were playing music early, and music meant a lot to you?
Yes, it did.
What did it mean to you?
Well, I don't know. As a young person, I think most young, if you observe like a 2- or 3-year-old, they're always pounding on something. I think music is in pretty much, if I I don't know if I'm right on this thing, pretty much in everybody's soul, not so much specific music, but like a rhythm that they walk to or a rhythm that they think to. But in my case, it was, you know, notes and melody and words and arranging, because I started listening to it, you know, as a young child. And so that's how I got into it. And I grew up in Denver, and my first instrument I played was the drums. But we had a lot of keyboards in our house, and I always played the piano on the side. But I played the drums for until I was about 13 years old.
Mm-hmm. How many instruments do you play?
Just the drums and the piano. That's all. And synthesizers.
And you do, you actually produce a lot of your own music, isn't that
yes,
right?
Yes, I produce a lot of my own music and a lot of other people's music, too.
And so you were, when you were 13, you were 13 when you did your first gig?
No, when I did my first gig, I was much younger. I was playing USO shows when I was 6 and 7 all over the world. You know, we traveled
wow.
all over the world and played USO shows.
What
and,
was that like?
Well, it was fun for me. We went, we had chaperones, and we had the selective service tutors, because I didn't really go to a school until I was equivalent to the fourth grade. But I got a good education on the boats and ships and planes we were on, and so I stepped right into the fourth grade. And you know, I didn't like being in a classroom. I was more at home on a stage in front of a bunch of soldiers.
So that was home for you, being
yeah.
on a stage in front of a bunch of soldiers who were usually cheering, right?
Yeah, and yelling and carrying on. But I realized that, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know if I realized it, but I just thought, well, school is, everybody goes to school, and it's my time to go to school, so I went to school.
What do you think your life would have been like if instead of going to school, you'd continued to study outside of school and done your music?
Well,
did you ever think about that?
No, I never thought about that. I think, though, but I have a few friends who homeschool their kids, and I think that the homeschooling, if the parent is equipped to do that, is a marvelous thing, particularly with the state of the educational system in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's my own opinion, and it may not be yours, but that's my opinion. But homeschooling is a good thing. But I don't know. I think that, you know, you have to go to school. I'm 58 years old, and in those days, if you didn't go to school, there was a thing called the truant officer who would come and look for you and take you to school.
Well, not if you were with the USO on stage.
Yeah. Well, I said, they had teachers there from the Selective Service that every day for 4 hours we had to learn the subjects.
Mm-hmm. So that was like a little tiny classroom? Or
was it was
you,
me.
Individual?
It was just me.
Ah.
I was the youngest person in the troop, and it was just me, and I had three teachers primarily the time I, for the... for about 6 years that taught me, you know, math and English and history and the things you learn in the first, second, and third grade and drawing and how to write and print and do cursive writing and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what really did it for me is when my father bought a television and I saw Elvis Presley on TV shaking, and I just knew right at that point, not that I wanted to be Elvis Presley, but I said, I want to do this music thing, and I never... second guess myself. All the way through school, I was a pretty good baseball player, but I always opted to play the piano rather than go play baseball. And when I was in college, you know, I played in the college jazz band. I got a scholarship to the University of Denver, which is a pretty prestigious school, on music.
Mm-hmm.
So it served me pretty well.
So what was it about seeing Elvis Presley?
I don't know. It's
no,
just that,
it was just something that hit you right in the gut?
Well, it seemed like that was the defining moment where I just said, yeah, I want to do this. I said music, it came easy to me, which is, you know, I have a lot of friends who believe in reincarnation, and I don't know that I believe it or I just believe it. I don't know, but it was just in me from the time I was a little kid. I loved music. And when I saw Elvis, I was a pretty rambunctious young person. I was jumping around and bouncing up and down, and I said, yeah, I want to do this thing. And so I never, you know, on the upside, I never had a midlife crisis. I never had to buy a Harley Davidson. I never questioned that what I did was the right thing with my life.
Well, you were a rocker, and that gave you a completely different kind of life than most people experience.
Yes, when I got to be 17 and 18 years old, and in the 60s, in the early 60s, you know, music had started to change. You know, when the Beatles came in, and times started to change in America. I remember, you know, when Kennedy was assassinated, you know, we realized that, you know, nobody was safe, and the age of innocence just, you know, was over, to use that cliche. But it just seemed that, you know, and at that time, you know, drugs started coming into the environment big time, and in the music business they were everywhere. And everybody was, you know, pretty much all the bands and all the lawyers and all the managers, everybody was getting high on illegal drugs. So that was a different time. Now I take cholesterol medicine, but I buy it legally.
Yeah, that's what you take is for your cholesterol,
yeah.
Right?
But I buy it legally.
And you actually try to eat organically, don't you?
Yes, I do. I am pretty healthy. I pretty much eat about 80% vegan. If anybody doesn't know what that means I very rarely eat dairy products, probably not at all, and I don't eat any turkey, chicken, or cow, or pig. I eat fish once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I do this just because I've read so many books written by, you know, doctors, and that's just an opinion that I know a lot of people out there might not agree with, but it's just my opinion, and I feel a lot healthier for it. I'm 58 years old. I don't have one thing wrong with me, and I think a lot of that is because of my diet.
Mm-hmm.
And
And are you different than other rockers your age? I mean, you grew
yes,
up.
Yes, I am.
You know all the rockers, right?
Well, I think that I am extremely different than most of the rock and roll people. I'm probably one of the only Republicans in the rock and roll world.
Mm-hmm. So you're a registered Republican.
I'm a registered Republican.
But you're not active.
No, I'm not. I gave money to the Republican Party before, but I stopped doing it. You know, we live in a democratic society and in a capitalistic, which is driven by capitalism, and you know, it's a pretty good system. There's a lot of problems in America. I don't know that I wouldn't know where to start if somebody elected me president. Where to go first? I wouldn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But
you do know rock. You do know the music.
Yes, the music.
Three Night Lady.
I know the music. Yes.
And you wrote a lot of other music too.
Yes, I did. I was fortunate to write songs for Roberta Flack and Peebo Bryson and Belinda Carlisle of the Go-Go's, and I've had songs in movies, I moved to Los Angeles when I was 21 years old, and I got right into hooking up with the right people, you know, to hone my craft and to, get things done.
Mm-hmm. And what's it like when you're writing a song? I mean, do you sit down and you say, I'm going to write a song, or just sort of come out of your soul?
Well,
or does it happen both ways?
It happens both ways, but I think I learned to keep a title book, a book of phrases that seems like it would be the song title.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then sometimes You know, I'll look at the title book, and the title will suggest what the song is about. And then you go about writing the songs. And what I do is I usually start on the piano, and then I start with this title, and I marry that to a melody, and then I try to think of all the things that have to do with this title that I'm writing about. And then I try to rhyme every third line, and then I write the chorus of the song, and then I go to a different chord and I start singing notes that feel right with these chords I'm writing, but I just go like da 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 da. Then I record that, then I listen back to it, then I write the verse words. and that's how I write a song. Sometimes I'll be sitting at the piano, not even intending to write a song, and something will come to me that ends up suggesting a title to me, and the song comes just like that.
It just sort of flows out of you?
It just flows out of you, yeah.
What song do you think that you wrote that flowed the most, that just sort of came out like magic?
Well, I've written so many songs, I'd hate to single one out, but recently I've been involved with a woman named Lynn, and I when I first met her, I wrote a song that was titled "I Like Her and She Likes Me."
that's sweet.
Yeah, and it just came out of me, all the words, and you know, and like sometimes, you know, I use the phrase, sometimes she acts like a 15-year-old brat, but then she sets me straight when I get off track.
Aww.
And you know, and she does, you know. But anyway, I was able to write.
Is that when you recorded?
I made a CD and gave it to her, and then all her friends wanted a CD, so I had to burn a bunch of CDs, you know.
Well, how sweet. Is that one that you're going to sell?
No, I stopped getting cuts many, many years ago, Melinda. Unfortunately, the music business, let me start by saying every business goes through changes and evolves.
Mm-hmm.
And the music business resembles nothing like what it was in the 1960s and 70s when I was in it.
Well, tell us about the difference.
Well, the difference was everything. When you and I were young, one station played the top 40 records. Do you remember that?
I certainly do.
They played
on my little pink radio.
R&B, rock and roll, novelty songs, maybe a song by Patti Page, country songs. And that's one thing that's different. Now, radio in every major city in the United States, the number one and two stations are generally talk radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's true.
And also, when you and I were young kids, we didn't have computers, or it didn't matter to us what tennis shoes we wore. We didn't have CD-ROMs. We didn't have you know, the things available to us. The kids today have so much available to them. When they walk into the mall, they may not go into the record store and buy a CD of Britney Spears. They may go buy some Van tennis shoes, or they may go buy some software for the Nintendo.
No, but they still love their music.
Well, they love their music, but they don't love it like we did. And I think that baby boomers were fortunate enough, are misfortunate enough, I should say, when Kennedy was shot and the Vietnam War was going on, and when the Kent State tragedy happened, there was a soundtrack of the 70s music coming at us, from the Beatles to the Rolling Stones to the songs of the day and to Bob Dylan songs. And I think that we married those songs to the events that were happening, to the songs when those events happened. And
you know, that's not happening today.
That doesn't happen today because a friend of mine who's still in the music business told me that 80% of all hit songs are hip-hop songs.
Huh.
Hip-hop, which I don't really know any hip-hop artists, but I kind of think that a lot of them, they get a rhyming dictionary, and because I listen to the words, and they don't really tell that great of a story like the songs that, you know, we wrote in the 60s and 70s. They were love songs. They told a story. But I know that the kids of today, they're smarter, younger than we were when we were their age.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to grow up faster. And music to our generation, baby boomers, was the thing. It drove us. We married it. We played ping pong with it back and forth. But the kids of today, I think they use it as they would, like a CD-ROM. It's something, yeah, they like the song, but so what? You know, they don't go see that.
It doesn't seem to resonate with them the same way it did with us.
It doesn't resonate with them the same as it resonated with the baby boomers. And I know this is true because the number two rated stations in the major markets are classic rock stations.
Because people are still listening to your music.
They're still listening to our music, and they want to hear A Stairway to Heaven at 12 o'clock noon every day. They do.
And it's not, but that's the younger generation that's listening to it.
Yeah, and the younger generation kind of listens to it, and I don't know that they, I think some of them, they want to know what this was. They want to know what is this music that drove our parents mad?
Do you think that there might be a market for that kind of music again then, something that really carries a story?
I think that there's always a market for something that really carries a story. Whether or not the song will get heard, though, I don't know.
But there, one of the things that you're doing is, you sell your music online.
Yes, we sell the CDs. We sell CDs of the band I'm in online. We sell, and these are old songs that we recorded, all the hits we had. And the band I play with, I play with other guys that had hit records, and we recorded our live show, and we sell that CD online, and we sell it at our shows. A merchandising company sells our CDs and T-shirts after we play.
Mm-hmm. Who you're in the Greats of Rock and Roll.
The Classic Rock, it's called the Classic Rock All-Stars.
All-Stars.
Yeah.
And who, could you tell the audience who it is that you actually...
Yes. Pete Rivera was the lead singer of Rare Earth, who sang I Just Want to Celebrate and Get Ready and all the other hits. And Mike Panera sang the song Ride, Captain, Ride on Your Mystery Ship.
Oh, yes.
And Dennis Noda sang the song Na 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 Na.
Yes.
And I sang Green Eyed Lady and some other songs. And we're doing it. Right now, you're talking to me. I'm down in Biloxi, Mississippi. We're playing at the Biloxi Coliseum out in the parking lot tomorrow for the Crawfish Festival, it's called.
Crawfish Festival.
The Crawfish Festival.
Well, you're going to get lots of crawfish then, I hope.
Yeah, I don't know. And right before we play, they're having a crawfish eating contest to give us time to set up our gear.
And that's an incredible group of people to be touring with.
Yeah.
What is it like to tour with them?
Well, we've had this group, believe it or not, for 14 years. And when we got together 14 years ago, I hadn't performed in a band in a few years, and neither had the other guys. Pete was teaching Little League Baseball, and Mike was making videotapes. And Mike and I, the guy from the Blues Image, and Mike also played with the Iron Butterfly, we went down and met with Pete, and we said, Pete, let's start a band, an all-star band. And Pete was kind of reluctant, but he eventually agreed, and then Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees, he was in the band to start with. He wanted to do something too, so the first band we had was Mickey Dolenz, Mike I, Pete, and Dennis Noda.
Ah.
And then Mickey stayed with us for about 8 months, and then he had to go back to England. He had some personal things he had to take care of.
So you've been touring this whole 14 years.
Pardon me?
You've been touring this whole 14 years.
Yes, all over the world, yes.
So what is a typical month like for you? Just give us an idea.
I live in Northern California. I live in Santa Rosa, California, which is in Sonoma County. from June to November, we do about 65 shows a year, mostly on weekends. I'll drive to the airport. I fly to the city. The other guys meet me in Chicago or Denver, or today they met me in Gulfport. We all fly from different places, and then we meet, and then we check in the hotel, and then we go do a sound check, and then we play the concert, and then we fly home. But a typical month for me is, I like to cook. I have a studio in my house. I do songs. Some people want song demos. I do song demos for them. I take walks. I surf the web for things I'm looking for. I'm studying the Italian language on this free website I found.
Ah.
So that was good.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I know one phrase, da Vinny, means okay.
It's da wonderful, Vinny. What
okay.
Because your name is Corbetta, and so
yeah.
You have an Italian background.
Right, but I don't speak Italian. If anything, I know a little Spanish from living in Los Angeles so many years. And
well,
So
you're going to learn Italian and go back to the homeland for a
while?
Well,
I like to learn Italian. And they say, I've read that as we get older, if we challenge our brains, it could maybe stop us from getting a little dementia when we get older, or Alzheimer's.
So this is also part of your health regimen.
Your health regimen, yes. You know, I work the jumble words in the newspapers. I try to do things to keep my brain active. So,
well, what's the funniest thing that ever happened to you, or the strangest thing that ever happened to you while you were on tour?
The strangest thing?
Strangest, most amazing, most wonderful.
Well, wonderful?
Your mind.
Oh, God. I don't know the answer to that. Every concert we do is great, Melinda. The people jump and they scream and they yell and they sing the songs with us, and it's great. And it's great.
Do you feel like sometimes they're going back in time with you?
Well, one time we were signing autographs, and this guy said to us, when you guys were playing, it made me feel like I still had hair on my head. So, yes, I guess they think that they remember. I've had many people coming up and saying to me, you know, I proposed to my wife when your song Green Eye Lady was playing on the radio, you know. Our son was conceived when we heard your song, you know.
How does that make you feel, knowing you've been that kind of part of other people's lives?
Well, it makes me feel good, if their life turns out good, but I don't want to be responsible for anyone but myself.
Well, and amen, of course not.
Yes.
But I know that you travel with, you know, three other rockers. There must be some interesting things that happen. Like, because they all have very different personalities, right? Do you all have the same kinds of eating habits?
No, Mike Panera and I are Mike is a vegetarian, but I was a vegan for many years, like I said earlier, but now I'm a pesce vegan, which means I do eat fish. Mike is a lacto pesce vegetarian. He eats a lot of cheese and dairy products. I don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And Pete and Dennis eat anything they want.
So they're just more omnivorous.
They're omnivorous. Yes.
So do you guys eat together when you're on tour?
Well, normally the promoter has to cater a meal for us, and in we have a rider that goes in our contract that says he has to get this certain amount of gear for us, and we have to have two vegetarian meals, not just salads or beans, you know, something. And so either that or they give us money and we go out and we eat what we want.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we do it.
But you guys have gotten to be very close, too, over the years, right?
Yeah, somewhat close. I think that Pete, the guy from Rare Earth, and I, we talk. We pretty much run the band, Pete and I. It just happened that way. And Mike lives in Florida, and he's involved in other ventures in the band. And Dennis Noda, he plays in our band, and he does a lot of side work in Los Angeles when we're not playing. So Pete and I probably have the only, if I can call it a relationship in the band. I mean, I talk to him almost every day about something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And what you do, would you say that you do it because you love it as much as anything else?
Yes. The traveling is getting harder, and airfares are getting more expensive. Mickey Dolenz once summed it up. He goes, you spend 24 hours traveling and 1 hour playing.
Well,
and that's true. Like, I got up at 3:45 this morning, and I have this shuttle come and pick me up at my house. I'm at my girlfriend's house in Roseville, which is by Sacramento. Drove me to the airport. I flew to Houston. Then I flew on this little plane to Gulfport, Biloxi, Mississippi, and this girl named Jill picked us up in a van, and we all came in at slightly different times, about a half an hour apart, and then we're all here, and we drove, and now we're in the hotel, but we play tomorrow at 5 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
So you've got some time to kill.
Yeah.
And you're in Biloxi.
I brought my Wall Street Journal, and I brought my things. I'm reading a book, and.
What book are you reading?
I'm reading Beach Music by Pat Conley. It was a big book years ago, and I never read it. It's 730 pages.
Mm-hmm.
It's a novel, you know.
Huh.
It's a novel.
And
I'm reading it. Well, when you live your life in planes and hotel rooms, you got to do something. And I got into reading years ago. As a matter of fact, I bought a book recently, and after reading 60 pages, I realized I'd already read that book.
Because you read so many books, you forget them, which makes it.
Yes, you do.
Isn't that what Reagan said about getting Alzheimer's? He could hide his own Easter eggs.
Yeah.
which I thought was a really funny.
Yeah, or you keep meeting new people.
Yeah, right home.
How you doing? Yeah.
Yes. But it sounds like your life is very much what you want it to be.
It is. My life is what I want it to be. I was talking to my girlfriend the other day, and she is an insurance broker. She owns the company with four guys. And she is, you know, she's not listening to this, I know, but she gets very stressed out. She comes home stressed out. And she doesn't love what she does. Every day she puts a business suit on, like a lot of people, and she goes to this office and deals with lawyers and her clients, and
mm-hmm.
on and on it goes. And I said to her, and she said to me, she goes, you know, you get on the plane, you're talking to people, they pick you up, they take you out to eat, you're playing a concert, everybody loves you, you're signing autographs, that's an exciting life. She says, you love what you do, and I don't love what I do.
Mm-hmm. Is that one of the gifts?
Probably a lot of people don't love what they do. They just do it until they get the gold watch and retire, I guess. I don't know.
So your life hasn't been about that at all.
Not at all. Your life has been
about what you're doing, exactly what you love every day.
Right. And it never, you know, the money never drove me, getting the money. But you know what? The money came because I did what I wanted. That my partner used to say, do something for fun and free, and the money will come.
Mm-hmm. And that's how it worked out for you.
Yes.
And you were, your first band was?
Sugarloaf.
But wasn't it called Chocolate Hair?
Yeah, we have the name Chocolate Hair. We started it in college, and then we got a deal, and then somebody at the record company said, this name has racial overtones. You don't have any Afro-Americans in the band. In those days, we call them black people.
Uh-huh.
But being politically correct. And I said, no. They said, so you have to think of a name. But, well, there's a mountain in Boulder, Colorado called Sugarloaf Mountain, and the guitar player and I started the band up there on his house, so we said, how about the name Sugarloaf? So that's how we got the name Sugarloaf.
Ah, well, that's an interesting story. And how,
yeah.
How long were you in Sugarloaf?
7 years.
Was that, of course, during the period of time when there was drugs.
And sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Rock and roll, and that was one of the defining things about that whole generation.
Yes, it was.
But you were touring then.
Yes.
And that's when you relocated to Los Angeles.
That's right. Yeah, I always wanted to come to California. I remember when I was 9 years old walking home in Denver in the winter, and a hailstorm started, and a piece of hail hit me on the head, and I felt my head and blood was coming out, and I just said to the universal God out there, I said, I'm getting out of this place as soon as I can.
Well, that was a good idea.
And I went to California. By the time I got to California, it was the end of that whole Jim Morrison, Arthur Lee, you know, it was at the end of the what was happening out there. I wish I would have gotten there 4 years earlier.
So what year was this? It was
I think I moved to Los Angeles like in 1971.
Ah, okay.
Mhm.
So you were still pretty young, but you feel like
I was pretty young, but I think I missed. Maybe it's probably good that I missed it. Who knows? If I would have been involved in it, maybe I would have been dead. I don't know, but I could just sense that none of the craziness, a lot of the craziness, had stopped
mm-hmm.
that I had heard about. You know.
But
so.
It was, but Sugarloaf did well, and it
yeah, we did well.
Years.
We toured a lot, and we sold a lot of records, and had a lot of fans, and. You know, and
then you went into the Four Seasons.
I started playing with Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons, and then we toured the world, and I played with him for 4.5 years. Then I quit.
Why did you quit?
I was tired of doing the Garden State Arts Center twice a year. It was the same old.
Got tired of that, huh?
Pardon me?
Got tired of that.
Well, there's another reason I quit, but I'd rather not say it.
Okay.
But went back to my friend Bob Crew, who wrote a lot of the songs for the Four Seasons, and we went back to New York to produce the soundtrack to this musical called The Leader of the Pack.
Uh-huh.
And that's how my connection with you, because that's where I met Cassie in New York.
That's
at the
right.
Astro Coffee Shop, and then for people listening out there, Melinda and I met when we were all pregnant going to the Alternative Birthing Center in Glendale.
That's right.
That's when we met. Yeah.
Yeah. And then actually one of the other things that came out of that was the song for the Perot campaign.
That's right.
The H. Ross Cannonball.
That's right.
which was another interesting experience.
That was a fun experience.
It was. Which, yeah. And, of course, that was a song that told a story.
Yes, it did.
And people really liked that song.
Yes, they did, yes.
Because they would start jumping up and down and dancing to the song. And that was, of course, 92. Was that the only political song you ever did? Ever produced?
Yes. Yes. The only one. I think it's I've heard other people say it's not smart for entertainers to get political.
Mm-hmm.
Get political. You're not paid for your political advice. You're paid to act, sing, or hit the golf ball.
Well, that's certainly true.
You know, I remember a story. I mean, I can say this now. Frankie Valli, we were playing at Wolf Trap in Washington, D.C., the big outdoor amphitheater,
mm-hmm.
right after Ronald Reagan got elected.
Ah.
And Frankie says after the third song to this audience, now you got to figure half the people out there are Democrats, the other half are Republicans, which you say, this is Washington, D.C., right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, so Frankie says over the mic, I'm sure glad we got somebody in the presidential office that knows what the hell he's doing. Well, after he said that, half the people got up and walked out.
Uh-huh, that's a lesson to you.
No, and so... after the show, I said, Frankie, I said, what did you, I said, Frankie, you're not paid. I said, did you politically align yourself with Ronald Reagan? Did you give him money? He goes, well, no. I said, well, then why didn't you shut the F up? I said, you alienated half of your fans out there. They left. They didn't like what you said. He goes, you know, but it was things like that, you know.
So you learned that the politics and music do not mix.
Unless you announced through a press agent that you politically align yourself with a certain candidate. If you do that, then you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
But then you run the risk of, you know, most elections are kind of close. So if you align yourself with the odds are, and the politician wins, you alienate some of your fans.
And well, you certainly wouldn't want to do that. And people
no.
do. They go to listen to music to sort of get away from that.
That's stuff. Right. They want to get away from it, and they want to believe that, you know, our world is better than their world or something like that. I don't know.
So they want to go back to a more innocent time, perhaps.
Yeah.
Something that felt more innocent to them, where they just experience themselves differently.
That's right.
There's a lot of that there. But one of the, in some ways, the H.R.S. Cannonball wasn't a particularly political song because, of course, Perot dropped out. You know, it wasn't a Republican or Democratic thing.
Do you think, let me ask you a question. Do you think he would have won if he would have stayed in?
No.
No?
No, I don't think he would have won. But the thing that was interesting about the song was that it had a particular ideological message. And when that campaign started, Perot didn't have an ideological message. What people were saying was, no, we don't want what there is. We want something else.
And that's a dangerous thing to say.
And so the point of the song was to give them something that they could be other. And
mm-hmm.
you remember the song was about getting rid of the IRS and putting
mm-hmm.
the country back on the economic tracks. And a lot of those things aren't really...
Well, I think we should
political.
Get rid of the IRS, too. Don't get me started, I mean.
Oh, well, hey, yeah.
I think that Steve Forbes, years ago, he ran on the 17th... You said earlier that I'm extremely political, but I don't voice my views. But I think that we need a flat 17% tax. And although I did vote for Mr. George Bush... And maybe he did get bad information, but I think we should pull our soldiers home from Iraq. I think that those people have been fighting for 6,000 years, and democracy may work for them, it may not. And I think we should stay out of it. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, then that certainly means that you definitely have political opinions.
Yes, I do. I have political opinions.
And that's a good thing. Why should
yes,
you
it is.
After all? You have a right to have any opinion you want.
That's right. This is America, after all.
Yes. But the Internet has changed what you do as a businessman, right?
Yes, it has. It has. It's changed almost every industry. I mean, a lot of people book airline tickets on the Internet. They show up with their boarding pass printed on a piece of paper. Internet banking, you don't have to pay bills. You can have the bank send them a check. I mean, the Internet has affected every industry. You know, I have a couple of different websites. I have a website called classicrockhouse.com, and I sell CDs by myself and Mark Farner, the guy from Grand Funk Railroad, and some guys in our band and other rockers.
Okay, so what's the chain is there? You get them produced yourself, and then you sell them directly so you don't have
No, these people produce them themselves, and I buy them at wholesale. I give them a couple of bucks, and then I sell them for more and make a little profit.
Well, that's, you see, then of course the Internet has been very helpful that way.
It's helpful that way, yes.
And people can find you. They can.
Well, like I said earlier, I'm learning Italian for free on the Internet.
Yeah.
I don't have to go spend $300 for that, you know, Rosetta Stone software.
No, you don't.
No.
It's amazing what you can get for free on the Internet.
I know.
And you have another website. It's the classicrockallstars.com?
Yeah, or it's just simply class, classsroc.com.
Ah. And so if people want to find out where you are or what
they
you're
just
doing,
click on that, either one of those sites, and hit concerts, and then it shows where we're playing, what time we're playing, and...
So look at all the people that could have been put out of business there. I mean, you have a lot of, like, PR agents and all different sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So you've sort of collapsed the infrastructure that used to be needed in the music industry.
Well, we PR agents, you hire them when something's going on that you think you can benefit from paying them the money, you know. But they're not a necessary thing for a rock and roll band. If you're big enough, you'll get free press anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it has made a big difference, and your costs are lower, and you can make more of doing it now.
Right? Yes, and you can do it. You can. I've heard of a lot of people making. I saw a guy. He used to be the manager of the bank in Northridge. I saw him in the supermarket one day, and I said, "How's the bank?" He goes, "I quit the bank." I said, "You quit the bank?" He goes, "Yeah, my wife started going to garage sale. We buy and sell stuff on eBay." He goes, "I'm making more money doing that than I was at the bank president." I said,
"Wow!
Don't tell me that." He goes, "I am."
Well,
because
that's
we have
sure
a
big change in the world.
Yeah. You must know people who make a living on eBay.
Well, no, I don't, but I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Most of the people I know try to, you know, they're making a living writing for the Internet.
Yeah.
Or doing something else on the Internet, or designing Internet sites, for that matter.
Right.
But it's made a huge difference.
Oh,
there are a lot of, and the computer itself, of course, made a huge difference because it sort of collapsed, you know, that the whole infrastructure and corporations.
Well, I read somewhere that last year the Internet business, the e-tail, they call it e-tail business,
mm-hmm.
earned more money than the retail business. That more money was spent back and forth on the Internet than was it people walking into Sears or Macy's buying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
On the Internet.
That's amazing.
It's amazing.
But yet, only still about 30% of the households have a computer and are on the Internet.
I know. And of those 30% that have a computer, what is the percentage of people who are actually using the computer? Probably lower than that, probably like 15. I don't know. But those 15% of the people are making a lot of waves.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes you wonder exactly who it is that, you know, that does actually the buying in the house. You think there must be a lot of women on the computer because they're generally the ones that do the buying.
Yes, I know. We put on the QVC network years ago for Earth Day, and they told us that their target audience was the 43-year-old divorced woman with two credit cards right next to the telephone. That's where they sell all the jewelry for $89 and $39.
Do they really? No,
yes, they did. He told me that that was their target market. Women who are home that are divorced, that sit home eating chocolates and angry, and they do impulse buying. I said, they're angry? He says, yeah, we've done the research. And they want to buy something. They think it's going to make them feel better. I said, that's really sad, but who am I to judge, you know?
Yeah.
So, but that's their market.
So you've been touring pretty consistently since you were 6 years old?
Pretty much. Well, I didn't from the time I was six through high school and first two years of college. It started right after college where I really started touring in big rock bands, and I'm still doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen the world, and that's a good thing.
Is there anything that you remember about seeing the world as a musician that really kind of stands out in your mind?
Is there anything what?
About seeing the world as a musician. I mean, you go, you tour. Is there an event, something that happened that really stands out in your mind, something wonderful or something surprising or funny?
Not funny. No. As I said earlier, no. All the shows are great. Sometimes we get rained on.
Well, that must. What do? You put up umbrellas?
Do I what?
Do you put up umbrellas? What do you do?
No, we don't play.
Oh, you just.
It's called an act of God.
Oh, an act of God. Therefore, we put it off.
Yes, but we still get paid.
Oh, hey, that's a really good act of God.
And so then everybody starts to become a believer. Everybody else is an atheist until it's an act of God and you get paid. Then they want to believe, oh, yes, God caused that. That was my joke.
That's funny. And you love music. Are you ever going to retire?
No.
You're going to do this until you just...
I don't know that I'll do this, but I'll always play the piano or teach piano or teach a course in music theory somewhere. I'm not going to retire. First of all, I don't know how to play golf, so what am I going to do?
You don't want to learn, right?
No. I'm too old to learn. 58. When you're 58, you start playing golf, I've heard that you start hurting your back because you're not 24 anymore.
Well, that was...
No, and you know what? Golf, except for golf, the truth is, and I hope I don't offend any golfers, I don't give two hoots about golf. I'd rather watch a baseball game or a basketball game.
Mm-hmm.
I played golf a few times, enough to know that I wasn't any good, and that wasn't why I didn't like it. I thought, well, I don't enjoy this, taking 5 hours to hit the ball in 18 holes. I didn't enjoy it. But other people, they live in, my girlfriend's brother is in Hilton Head, South Carolina. They flew there this morning. They're playing 10 of the major golf courses. They live and die for golf.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I guess it's...
Yeah, everybody has their Jones.
Everybody has their thing. They have the everybody
thing
that
has
they
their
love.
Thing.
But and it's wonderful that you've been able to live your life in a way that gave that let you be everything that you wanted to be, and you know experience all of the things that you have, and you've got so much more to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you still write songs.
Yes, I do. I write songs because I'm a songwriter, and I mean, I wrote a song about Sarah Moulton on the Food Channel.
And you just wrote a song for your girlfriend.
And I wrote a song for my girlfriend. If something inspires me, you know, I write a song about this. I wrote a song. I went to Hawaii with this girl that I used to hang out with, and then we met again 30 years later, and we ended up going to Hawaii together. And I wrote about, the song is called Down in Maui. I wrote about our experience in Maui, all the things we did and what happened to us, and it's a really good song. I did it like in a reggae feel. Down in Maui, dun da dum dum da da dum.
That's
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I mean, I don't wake up every morning and say, "Oh, I'm out to write a song." It doesn't happen that way. But if something is on my mind and I'm thinking about it and I can mull it into a melody and a chorus and a verse, I'll write it.
What a gift.
Well, yeah.
It's about time for us to close for the night, but Jerry, I want to thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Melinda.
And I know you're a busy guy, but I'm just going to ask you to say hello to the guys for me.
Okay.
And I hope you're going to have a wonderful show.
I will, Melinda.
And I'll be talking to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
You take care. Keep the music going.
I shall. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's our show for tonight, Friday, April 21st, 2006. Hearing about how someone like Jerry has made their life better and freer using the Internet, which gives you a matrix, a network, instead of a centralized supplier, gives us a hint about the things out there that are possible, and it's really nice that Jerry could spend time with us. The point of being free is owning yourself and your life. The point of owning your life is becoming uniquely a better person. Thanks to all of you for being with us, for listening and thinking about where we are and where we want to be. Life is process, and in this way we're working to help all of us understand that government is a tool, at times complex, at times simple, but just a tool intended to do for us what we cannot do directly, if such exists. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. A mission statement encapsulates where we want to go. It's like a direction finder. And it's up to us to reach the direction. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing inevitably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. And that was what Thomas Jefferson said in 1776, and it's still true today. Sometimes we're moved to action because the dictates of conscience make any other course impossible to contemplate. But freedom always remains our destination and goal. Thanks for all the music you've given to the world, Jerry. What would the world be without people like you? This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.